Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller, and today we're talking to the author of our second book club book of the year, and we're doing it today with Jim Gool. Jim is the award-winning author of 11 Miles to Oshkosh and many short stories. The book we're talking about today is his latest, and it's titled South of Luck. So have you had a chance to read it? What do you think? What questions do you have about the book? I hope you'll join in today as we talk with him. Number to call is 1-800-642-1234. It's 800-642-1234. Or you could send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. ideas@wpr.org. Jim Gool, welcome back. Good to have you with us again.
Thank you, Larry. Glad to be here.
So for those who may not have read it yet, give us the basic story of the book.
Well, as you already spelled out, it's set in the tail end of the World War II period. So the entire story takes place in the summer of 1945. And our main character, a 16-year-old named Milo Eggerson, I'd call him a pretty serious troublemaker in Minneapolis. They've got a file 2 inches thick in Washburn High School there under his name. Anyhow, his mom sends him against his wishes on the train from Minneapolis to the little towns of Milltown and Luck, Wisconsin, in Polk County, about 70 miles from his home. Back then, they had rail service, and so he rode passenger train from Minneapolis to the Milltown Depot, and the person he's going to stay with is an old farmer named Hjalmar Rehnquist, nicknamed Ham, and Ham lives on a rundown farm all by himself. He's got one hand is injured. He needs the help, and so he welcomes it. Anyhow, the story explores Milo's very rough beginning, let's say, at making friendships in this rural area, and explores his unique aptitudes and abilities as he eventually finds a way not only to make friends, but to solve a pretty serious problem in his life, which is a man who's set out to finish the harm he started on him. It's his stepfather. A guy who put a very nasty scar on his face and will soon be let out from Stillwater Prison in Minnesota, and has vowed to finish the job he started on Milo.
Yeah, it's quite a story. I really enjoyed it. You know, your last book, 11 Miles to Oshkosh, that was sort of set in the time frame that you lived in. This book, as you say, it's set in 1945. And why did you pick that year?
Well, I knew I wanted to write about this region north of where I live. And I have friends from up there. I've gotten to know the region through them and also through deer hunting. We had a deer hunting camp just across the county line in Washburn County. And I started hearing stories like you do at deer camp. And one of the gentlemen told about when he was 16 years old and he was an after work farm helper in, I think it was near Amory, Wisconsin, where he was helping out. And he said he showed up after school one day to help the farmer. And lo and behold, there were a busload of German prisoners showed up to do work on the farm. And the farmer said, "Wendell, I want you to supervise these guys. They're going to cut the tops off of every rutabaga in this pile." The farmer goes on to hand a machete to each one of the German soldiers, and my friend Wendell was scared witless. Well, when I heard that, and I heard that there was a little-known German prisoner of war camp in Milltown, Wisconsin, called Camp Milltown, that locked me in on a time. I wanted to include that in the book. And so that puts us in the year 1945.
That makes a lot of really good sense. You know, back that time, do you think it was harder for a kid growing up then, back in those days?
In some ways, I think it's harder. I think in some ways easier. It was certainly simpler. Take Milo's circumstances, where he's accustomed to living in the city, and all of a sudden he's moving into a place with no running water. They literally had to pump it in the house and in the barn with a hand pump. No electricity yet, although the rural electrification was well in progress by then, but on the Ham's farm, not quite there with electricity yet. And just a tough way to get by, as the book indicates in certain parts. Some days they had meat to eat with their meals, some days they didn't. And of course, things were rationed for World War II as well.
Yeah. Yeah, I was thinking about my own young life on a farm where I had to climb up in the silo and throw silage down for the cows to feed, which is what Milo had to do. It was something I could definitely relate to, because it was, although we had electricity, of course, but we didn't have a silage unloader, unfortunately. I was the silage unloader sometimes. Oh, man. So what kind of research did you have to do for the book?
I had to do a lot of research because I wasn't around then. The first thing we did was drive around those towns. I already knew them pretty well. I wanted to find the historical marker for this Camp Milltown. That took some doing. It was not in an obvious spot. And I was up there with my girlfriend, Carmen, and she says, well, why don't you ask that guy there? And it's a guy was pulling his wagon, an old gentleman, and his granddaughter was in the wagon. And I'm like, do we really want to bother him? Well, I rolled down the window and I asked him. And he said, follow me. And slowly following grandpa with the granddaughter, we got a trip to the historical marker. And so that was step one, but that led to another step in research, and that is Lester was the man's name who helped me. He introduced me to a man and a woman in Milltown who were high school student age during the year 1945. And they were kind enough to just invite us into their home. And for, I think, about an hour and a half, I interviewed them. And so I got all sorts of great tidbits from that interview, including knowledge that there really was an enemy aircraft observation post on top of the school, and much more than that. I got a whole bunch of real-life observations and insight into Milltown, Luck, Frederick, and the whole area up there. I also went to the Osceola Public Library, went through a whole year of microfilm of the Osceola Sun newspaper. There's a really good museum, Polk County Museum in Balsam Lake. And some folks there helped me out, helped me find my way through the file cabinets and get interesting information, some of it about the Native American population that was in Polk County. So, yeah, it was way different than 11 miles to Oshkosh, where I could rely on my memories, because I told a story of the same years when I was in high school in the place I grew up. So this one, it was fun to do the research, but it was a lot.
You know, actually, some authors that I've talked to say they like doing the research more than the writing itself. What about you on that?
It was fun and totally interesting, and I met new people along the way. So it's close to being as good as writing, but I really do enjoy writing.
Well, and this is your second book, and of course you've written a lot of short stories. Because this is your second book, were some things easier for you?
I would say some things were. I kind of knew where I was, what the process was better. I also kind of knew from 11 Miles to Oshkosh, where people appreciated that the characters were kept very busy with a lot of subplots, I decided I'd keep that theme, make sure there's kind of like woven in and out of the main mystery story with the bad guy. There's a lot of subplots throughout this story, just like with 11 Miles to Oshkosh. So I learned to keep that going. I guess that's my answer to that.
How long did it take you to write the book?
It took me, I would say, a year and a half to 2 years to get it written to the point where it was good enough. You know, it took me probably a year to write the first draft, and then another year with the help of members of my writers group reviewing it and marking it up with red ink to get it shaped up good enough. And then the University of Wisconsin Press was real helpful in giving me guidance. They had a point of view on certain aspects of the book that they wanted me to scrutinize and tighten up. And so I did that. I would say 2.5 years altogether.
So it's not something you just sit down. Well, any book is not something you just sit down and dash out in a couple of weeks. There's a lot of work behind it. Well, let's talk some more about Milo. Did you know kids like him?
Yeah, I did. I think most people who went through high school knew kids like him. You know, just a kid who liked to hang out with buddies in the alleys, as he describes it, maybe kicking a headlight on a parked car once in a while. Kind of a rotten thing to do. But in his case, and in the case of many kids, kind of a reformation project required, and Milo got some reformation up on the farm with him.
Well, and you do, I think in both your books, you do a really good job of getting into the mind of a teen, and your memory is probably a lot better than mine. I mean, is it easy really for you to remember that, those sorts of things?
I like to write in the first person about kids that age, and it's almost easier for me than writing somebody my own age. I mean, there's a fair amount of kids still in me, but I enjoy writing about a young protagonist like that, you know, and go ahead and follow their bad decisions and their not very well refined language some of the time, that sort of thing.
And you do tell the story from his perspective. That process is sounds like you feel that's a very comfortable way to go about doing it. It's I got to be difficult to do. I mean, as I was reading it, I was thinking about that. That's for me. That would be a hard way to write it.
Are you talking about with lots from of subplots?
Yeah, well, with Milo, talking about the whole thing from Milo's perspective and then dealing in with the subplots and all.
Yeah, it's a woven together thing. I mean, each character has different interests, and Milo's connected with a whole bunch of them. And so he's pulled in different directions in different chapters. One of the things that I find is that good ideas for maybe we should have the main character do this. Good ideas come to me in the middle of the writing of the book. So I don't know always where I'm going to take it. I certainly don't outline the whole thing. It just doesn't feel like the natural way for me. So I sit down and I start writing, but the bad byproduct of that is sometimes I write myself into a corner and I have to back up and throw away a couple chapters and then put it in gear again and try a different direction.
Oh, man. Our guest today is Jim Gool, and his book title is South of Luck. It's our second book of the month, our book club selection, excuse me. Great to have him with us today. And you may have some thoughts on that, maybe have some memories of growing up during World War II. Was there a special summer that influenced your life a lot? What would you like to know about Jim's writing process? You can give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us the email address ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Tyler Ditter, our engineer today, Jill Nadeau, our producer, I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Just a quick announcement or note. A congressional panel investigating the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol holds its next public hearing today. Former Acting Attorney General Jeff Rosen and two others from the AG's office are expected to testify. You can join us this afternoon at 2 for live NPR coverage here on Wisconsin Public Radio and at WPR.org. But right now, I hope you'll join in with questions or comments for our guest today, Jim Gould, award-winning author, and his book, the one we're talking about today, is titled South of Luck, set in Wisconsin, in Milltown and Luck, Wisconsin, in 1945, the summer of 1945. That's during World War II and right up to the end of World War II. You can join in. You have some memories of that time or maybe some special summer experiences that really influenced your life. What would you like to know about the story itself? Give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us, the email address, ideas@WPR.org, ideas@WPR.org. You know, let's talk about Milo a bit more. He has a scar. You mentioned that physically and mentally he has a scar as well. How does it all affect him in the book?
He seems like he's always itching for a fight, always kind of on the defense, who's out to get me next kind of a kid. And as he moves into this whole new territory where he knows nobody, he finds that that doesn't work as well as on the streets of Minneapolis. He's a pretty hard kid to like in the first 50 pages of the book.
Yes, he is.
But he does change. At one point in the first 50 pages, he steals some cigarettes and gets pounded pretty hard by the young bartender who discovers it. And there's a lesson learned there. Then he's all set to go back to Minneapolis because nobody likes him here. You know, there's a lot of self-pity going on somewhere in chapter 10 area or something like that. And eventually Ham shows up at the depot where he's trying to leave and talks him into staying. And eventually, you know, and Ham does a good job of this, helps Milo realize his very good qualities, some very good qualities. For example, he's very good with the animals on the farm. He's very good mechanically where Ham isn't. So he's very aware of people who need help. There's a young kid named Gilbert about his age who's got a rougher life than he does by far because he's being abused by his father. And Milo makes it a personal mission to help Gilbert. And so you can see him grow and you can see that, yeah, this fighting instinct gets him into a lot of trouble. But there are other instincts that he has that are positive ones, and he kind of develops them all at the same time.
Yeah, you know, I was thinking about that because I didn't like him, as you might expect. I didn't like him right away, but there were things I noticed right away because he did listen to his uncle. He did climb that silo and pitch down the silage. He was a little, you know, I don't think he much liked it, but he went ahead and did it right away and did the work. And so that was kind of the redeeming quality I was getting out of him myself as I was reading through the book.
Yeah, he also, like in Lindu Drugstore, if he saw a kid staring at the gumball machine, he'd pull out a penny and give it to that kid or put it in the slot and turn the crank. So you could tell early on, although you didn't see much of it, that there was a positive side of Milo Eggerson, and maybe he could become a good citizen along the way before he was done.
Well, let's take some calls. Again, you can join in. The number's 800-642-1234. Alice in Fall Creek, thank you for calling.
Hi. I'm wondering if the author knows the book Stalag, Wisconsin, written by Betty Cowley?
I certainly do. I own a copy of that book, and I think it's outstanding.
I bought a copy of it also, and I found that my mother was in it, and I never knew anything about it.
Yeah, the German prisoner of war camps in Wisconsin were a major entity. There were 30 some, at least 30, spread around Wisconsin. And I don't think they got talked about much by the newspapers back then, but they were a big deal. Milltown had over 300 prisoners all by itself.
And Milltown itself wasn't that big, was it, Jim?
Not very big at all. I think it was probably, I don't know what the population back then, maybe 1,000 tops. So this big German prisoner population made a big effect on the town, a lot of it for the good. You know, there was a labor shortage, and Stokely's canning factory in Milltown needed the help, and they got it from the prison camp.
Alice, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Let's turn to Dennis in Two Rivers. Hi, Dennis.
Good morning. I was thinking with South of Luck, with the thing of luck, people make their luck with their choices. Now, other people have influence or control some aspects of our lives, but we make the choices and determine whether we have good luck or bad luck to a big extent. And just thinking with you being able to focus on writing from a teenage point of view is sometimes we parts of us seem to be broken off or stuck in various parts of our lives, and maybe part of you is still like a teenager. I'll hang up and listen.
Okay. Comment, Jim.
Yeah, maybe part of me is still a teenager. I wouldn't argue that. And people do make their own luck and determine what becomes of them through their own doing. The luck is a byproduct of their actions, right? In a lot of cases. In chapter one of this book, you get a good dose of Milo creating his own bad luck. And it's not luck. It's what he did. He got at the depot. There was nobody there to greet him. He ended up wandering over to a tractor implement store and getting himself in a whole lot of trouble. and so there's an example of where he made some rotten luck for himself. But in the book, he connects with people who end up being, there's a woman named Mrs. Quigley in this book. And by the end of it, that character bestows a lot of good luck on Milo Eggerson.
I love that character, and it was such a pleasant surprise to see how her character develops at the end of the near the end of the book. She really is quite a nice person, and well, we'll get to some more of that. But we've got some emails too. I wanted to get to Laura in Coleman email to say how much she enjoyed your book. She loves the way the writing just flowed from one chapter into another. One of those books she couldn't put down. She simply enjoyed reading it. And then she even purchased a copy for her mother to read. Her mother, I guess, was 13 years old in 1945 and grew up on a farm. So it brought back a flood of memories for her mother. Did you have to do research into farming back then? And she also mentions the PW, the prisoner of war camps.
I did do research into farming back then, and quite a bit of it. You know, there's a lot of YouTube out there where you can watch people cultivating a field behind horses. And I watched that one carefully. So when Milo was in the chapter where he was asked by Ham to cultivate, his first question is, what do you mean cultivate? and because he didn't know that agricultural term. And Ham explains that it amounts to getting the weeds out between the rows, and then Milo wanted to try to find a tractor to borrow, but Ham said, "No, you're going to do it behind these two horses." And so, yeah, there was a lot of research, but it was fun research. How did they deal with the milk when there was no refrigeration? And in their case, they put them in the cans. I think they were 10-gallon cans, and then they pumped well water in a basin to keep the cans cool until they could make it to the creamery. Yeah, it was a ton of fun learning about agriculture in 1945.
Yeah, and it brought back some memories even for me. Once again, I remember the first time my dad put me on the tractor to disc a field. And at some point in the process, I was so worried about getting it just right. I couldn't turn properly, and I backed up. And when I backed up, of course, I reset the disc unbeknownst to myself so that it was not discing the way it should. And I went back and forth across the field a couple of times before my dad noticed. He was upset, but he wasn't too upset with me. He just said, "Well, that's something you learned." But it brought back a bad story in a way for me, but it was also a good lesson too. Jeremy emailed to ask if the old German camp became the Boy Scout camp that was near Luck.
I don't know the answer to that. It's my understanding that it was mostly tents with a few long buildings, but I don't know what it became when it was dismantled. I know one gentleman in Frederick who is aware of how one of the buildings was moved to a farm for miscellaneous use, but I think it was mostly tents, and I don't know if it became the Boy Scout camp.
Yeah, of course, I obviously don't know either. Maybe somebody from Luck is listening or from Milltown is listening, and they'll call in and let us know. Again, that number, by the way, is if you have a comment or a question, experience to share, it's 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or email to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Jeremy emailed to ask if the, I'm sorry, Pat in Superior emailed that she loved the book. Now she's going to Oshkosh. She loved, but she did love to see Milo growing up in one summer. And sometimes that happens, doesn't it? You know,
I think it does. The summer comes to an end, and my gosh, he's not only been changed by the locals, but the locals have been changed by him. And you're just about ready to think that he's a full-fledged good citizen, and then the last page of the book shows up, and he stomps on the bell cord in front of the co-op gas station and starts more trouble.
Oh, man. Becky in Baraboo emailed. She and her husband just visited our wonderful Veterans Museum in Madison. They were especially interested in seeing the POW jacket and reading the story about Albert Neuenfeld, who supervised German prisoners of war. Albert and a prisoner, Kurt Bettner, became lifelong friends. Becky was wondering if you've seen that jacket too, and if it perhaps helped with the story itself. She's looking forward to reading your book.
Oh, great. I have not seen the jacket. I think you said it's in Madison somewhere.
Yeah, it's at the Veterans Museum in Madison.
Okay. I'll make a note because, I get to Madison once in a while.
Well, you should, and it's the Vets Museum is just a wonderful museum, so it's certainly worth that. You know, there's somebody we haven't mentioned yet, or maybe just in passing, a person in the book, Grayburn Jackson, and I wanted to hear more about him.
Right. Grayburn Jackson, in the year 1945, he's so old, I don't think anybody even knows how old he is. But he is a likable guy who, you know, by his age and the year we're talking about, he's obviously lived through some pretty severe prejudice.
He's a Native American guy.
Native American prejudice in the clusters of the Ojibwe tribe that exists up there. And yet he's got this very good attitude and this likability, and he and Ham are friends already. They must be longstanding friends, and Ham takes Milo up to visit him, and Grayburn is just as nice as can be, even though Milo isn't the nicest kid there is. And it evolves. We eventually learn to get very acquainted with Raina Jackson, the granddaughter of Grayburn Jackson, and then Len Jackson, Raina's cousin, three Native American characters in the book. And Grayburn is unusual also for the fact that he decides to give Ham a gift, and that gift is a crow.
Yeah. I wondered if there was some in your mind. What is the crow? The crow is named Black Cat, I think. What does that represent in the story?
It just represents the quirkiness of two guys like Grayburn Jackson and Ham. I mean, Grayburn named it Black Cat. Ham already had a cat named Peacock, and so off we go with a story where the crow is named for a cat, and the cat is named for a bird.
Oh, and you mentioned Raina. That's Grayburn's granddaughter, Raina. It has a wonderful character. I really liked her a lot. But tell us a bit more about her.
Right. For a lot of people I've talked to, that's their favorite character.
Yeah.
Is Raina Jackson. She's quiet and she's mysterious. And when Milo and Ham are over there visiting Grayburn, and she's kind of peeking around the corner of the kitchen. And she doesn't say too much, and she's slow to make friends, especially with the type like Milo. Later on, though, she gives Milo some useful advice a couple of times.
Yes.
Milo's fishing in Mackenzie Creek for trout, and because Ham said, if you want meat tonight, you better go catch some. And so Raina says, if you go upstream, you'll catch more fish, but stay away from the beaver dam. And Milo, of course, thinks that that's a good fishing spot, I bet. She wants it all to herself. Well, Milo learns the hard way that he should have stayed away from that beaver dam. Raina also gives, you know, Raina kind of makes a little project out of Milo.
Yeah.
She also tells him, if you're going to fight the white kids around here, you're going to have to learn to do it better than that, because they all belong to a boxing class. The high schools in Polk County taught boxing as part of Phi Ed, and they had boxing teams that were competitive in the district. And she says, if you're going to fight these guys, you're going to have to learn to do it better than that. I've got a cousin, Len, who could teach you if you're interested. And so here's Raina, you know, she's wary, but she makes a little project out of helping Milo along. And he eventually warms up to her, too.
Let's go to Anson in Trout Valley next. Hi, Anson.
Hi, Larry. Good morning.
Morning.
Just perfect timing. Just pulled into my driveway. I was just calling because I'm fascinated by these books that are written by people in St. Paul, because they're historical in nature. I lived in Wausau for 5 years back in my early days, and when I was in my 20s working for a small airline up there, and that was my induction, being a Chicago boy, into the state of Wisconsin. And it was an initial culture shock for me to live there, and then I realized how much there was. And when you read books like this, I read another book, I think Edgar Sawtelle, that I heard about at some point. I just, it's nice to be able to have these kind of referential documents written that you can look back and enjoy it and read and picture the state of Wisconsin as it was back then. So just kind of an encouraging thought not only your show, Larry, because I love listening to you, but as much as for Jim and the likes of him.
Oh, Anson, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. A nice thing to hear, isn't it?
Sure is.
Go ahead.
The Edgar Sawtelle book that he references is a wonderful book. It's been out for probably 20 plus years not by now, but it's a wonderful book if anybody wants one that's about Wisconsin, fictional story about Wisconsin.
Yeah.
But I totally, it sounds like he's grown to love the state of Wisconsin, and I've lived most of my life here, but I love it too. And I like to tell stories about different places in Wisconsin, and even the short stories that I've collected that I've written over the years, most of them are about different scenes in Wisconsin, some of them downtown Milwaukee, others different remote corners of the state. But I agree, it's fun to write fiction that's regional, that people who live there can relate to.
Let's go to Nancy in Grafton next. Hi, Nancy. Thanks for calling.
Hi, I'm down here in Grafton for many years, but came from Marathon County, and I was on 160-acre dairy farm. Our buildings were in the middle of 100 of the 160 acres, so in the wintertime, when it would snow to beat heck, you know, you couldn't get out of your driveway because it took a big caterpillar to come and plow out the roads. So my dad, our school was like 2 miles from our house. My dad would take the stone boat and he would clean out the barn in the afternoon. But to get to school, he would go and put new straw in our stone boat and a big horse blanket. And we would jump in the stone boat and he'd hook up the horses and away we would go 2 miles over the snow banks and stuff to go to school. And there was three in my class. I was two boys and me. And I think we had about 23 all together in the Johnson School. But I remember when I was a little kid how it was World War II, of course, and we had a lot of German prisoners of war that were brought over to Wisconsin and to Marathon County. And, of course, there were a lot of people there that had different kind of farms, like mink farms and all that stuff. And these prisoners of war worked there because there were a lot of German people, and they knew how to speak German, and the prisoners knew how to speak German. And you know what? Those German, a lot of them, they never went back to Germany because they're American citizens.
Yeah, some of them ended up becoming American citizens. I do think they made them all go back, but some of them saw enough of America to want to do a U-turn and settle there, and some did. On your story that you just told about the farm experience, getting a ride through the snow from your dad, what was that, a snowboat?
Yeah, a stone boat.
Stone boat. Okay, for picking stones. That is a neat story. My advice is write it down. I mean, even if it's just a one-pager, it would be a really nice one to preserve, to give people a little snippet of what it was like where you grew up.
Yeah, I think so too. Nancy, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it very much. Jim Gould, our guest today, and he is the author of South of Luck. Again, you can join in 800-642-1234, email to ideas@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mealer. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.